Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. South Sudan's Vice President in charge of economic cluster says financial reform is key to development in his country.
PML is the big bulk of the revitalized peace agreement. The overall mandate is to maintain aggregate fiscal discipline compatible with microeconomic stability.
And some students who failed exams at Dr. John Garang Memorial University in Jonglei State locked down offices at the institutions in protest.
We used to sit our exam, and when you fail one subject, you come for supplementary, and if you are passed, you come and join the classes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's Vice President in charge of the economic cluster says the 2021-2022 fiscal year budget faces challenges. James Waniga says the government's economic cluster aims to create more reforms and deal with inherent challenges in the country. David Monodanga reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking in Juba on Monday at the economic cluster's first policy reform seminar since the signing of the 2018 peace agreement, Vice President James Waniga addressed the theme, Reigniting Economic Recovery and Inclusive Growth, or PFM reform stipulated in Chapter 4 of the peace deal, is vital in resource allocation equality across South Sudan.
PFM is the backbone of the revitalized peace agreement. The overall mandate is to maintain aggregate fiscal discipline compatible with microeconomic stability and proper growth. It is to allocate resources consistent with priorities.
Iga says South Sudan has abundant minerals and natural resources that remain largely unexploited, with the exception of oil. He noted the 5.5-year conflict crippled South Sudan's economic growth, but said lawmakers must adhere to the economic reforms spelled out in the peace deal by encouraging people to increase food production and diversifying the economy.
And oil has been amounting to less than 2%, because there were grants and so on, and all total to 2%. This is very miserable. That means 98% of our revenue and therefore GDP emanate from oil. This is very misleading. It's like a desert mileage. Misleading totally. It's supposed to be the opposite. What if tomorrow we deplete the oil and it is fast depleting anyway, whether we like it or not?
Iga says South Sudan must stop relying on neighboring countries to provide food. Christy Iancora, United Nations Development Programme or UNDP Deputy Resident Representative for South Sudan, says the stakeholders of the peace agreement should identify ways to reform public finance management and strengthen financial institutions as part of the country's economic recovery.
The team is not for nothing. A lot has been done. There's still a lot more to do. And so this conversation and the subsequent 11 that are supposed to come is all part of that attempt for all of us, no matter which sector or ministry you belong to identify how you can be part of that reignition of economic growth, such that the ideals that were put together in the RRSS, but also in the revised national development strategy, can be achieved for the betterment of South Sudan and South Sudanese.
Iancora says the UNDP will support the country as it seeks to improve its public finance institutions at all levels.
We will continue to engage with the government and other stakeholders to strengthen economic policy, institutional capacities, and legal frameworks for the economic cluster. But it's not just for the economic cluster, but for all other important sectors of the economy. And particularly as state institutions are being put in place, we also want to continue the support to states, whether it's in planning, public financial management such that the good work being done at the national level will also be cascaded to the state level.
She says once South Sudan has strong states with the capacity to deliver services, it can say economic development has improved across the country.
Apart from the ongoing reforms in public expenditure management, revenue administration and procurement management, a set of complementary reforms are underway. We are bent on doing them to scale up efficiency of the public sector. This is the aim. Notable among them are, number one, a number of laws have been enacted to strengthen the regulatory framework to bring financial discipline in the operation of certain key institutions.
IGA says widespread digitalization reforms are underway to cover the national government all the way down to the Boma level. He says these reforms will improve service delivery and reduce corruption across the country. Chapter 4 of the peace agreement provides for economic and financial management reforms to achieve transparency in the management of oil revenues from oil and non-oil revenue collections. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
South Sudan's Minister for Information says he expects the parties to the revitalized peace agreement to reach a deal this week on the leadership structure of the unified forces to pave way for their graduation and deployment. Michael Makui says the unity government is serious about implementing key provisions of the 2018 peace deal within the remaining year of the transitional period. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
In an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, government spokesman Michael Makwe says once the parties agree on the command structure of the unified forces, it will implement the plan.
We are now in the process of graduating the forces, the unified forces. The forces are already trained and unified, and there was only a problem of the command. And the issue of the command is being addressed these days, so we are expecting that by this within this week, the issue of the command will be completed.
Last month, the Joint Defense Board said the question over how the unified forces will be led remained a challenge that the parties needed to solve. In recent months, the SPLM in government has said it wants to share the leadership of the unified forces with the SPLM in opposition and South Sudan Opposition Alliance, OSHOA, on a 55-45 ratio, but the SPLM-IO has said the leadership should be 50-50. Makwe says the unity government is ready to graduate the forces, but some of the troops have sticks rather than guns. The SPLM in government has repeatedly blamed the ongoing arms embargo by the international community for delaying the graduation of unified forces. South Sudanese policy analyst Jok Madud Jok says government officials who insist their hands are tied by the arms embargo are not being realistic.
I find this argument not logical, and it is simply unacceptable. I say this because you don't need guns in order to graduate soldiers from cantonment camps. What we are more interested in is the organizational aspects of the unification of forces. We are interested in the determination of who will be sent home and who will remain in the force.
Makwe also claims mediators from the international community forced the SPLM in government to accept provisions of the peace deal that are impossible to meet.
The agreement came up with a lot of issues that ought to be done at a go, which is not possible. Because in the agreement there are some provisions to which we objected and we wanted them amended, but we could not do so because there was that pressure also on the other side, and between the mediators were the way the mediators were behaving was not also acceptable. But what we had to do was accept whatever they say.
Marquez says some provisions of the peace deal, including the establishment of the National Constitution Amendment Committee in Chapter 1 and the establishment of the leadership of the Special Reconstruction Fund in Chapter 3 to be run by foreigners, were not written in the interests of the parties. Chapter 1's reconstitution of the national legislature and the establishment of independent statutory commissions at the executive level have yet to be completed. Marquez says the unity government wants to ensure that the provisions of the deal are implemented within the remaining year of the transitional period.
But in case of any delay, then definitely the parties will decide. Parties to the agreement will be the decision makers. They will be sitting, all of them, and decide what to do. Either to go for elections and ignore some of the provisions of the agreement and we go for elections, or else let us implement all the provisions of the agreement before we go for elections, and in this case we may have to extend the period.
Last month, the EU ambassador to South Sudan said a lack of political will by the parties has delayed the implementation of the deal. Marquez disagrees. He says the delay is caused by the parties' differences on the reconstitution of the parliament.
Well, the parties know their share, and they know the numbers they needed from them. Unfortunately, most of the parties to the agreement could not make the presentation of their candidates in time. And as a result, the formation or the establishment of the national legislature, that is the Council of States and the National Legislative Assembly, delayed.
Marquez acknowledges there are too many weapons in the hands of civilians across the country, but claims the government has no security force to collect them so they can be used by the unified forces. Marquez says he is optimistic that if the parties work hard, elections can be held as scheduled in February 2023. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Activities at the Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology in Bordertown have come to a standstill after students who failed exams shut down the institution. Some students say they have been discontinued or asked to repeat classes. The academic registrar at the John Garang Memorial University confirms more than 150 students shut down operations at the university. Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
Aleu Bol, a fourth-year student in the College of Agriculture, says the students are protesting what he calls an unfair decision by the university's administration to discontinue certain students and ask others to repeat classes.
We spent 2020 down without going back to school, and even 2021. Then when we come back, we find that the system was changed. We used to sit our exam, and when you fail one subject, you come for supplementary, and if you are far, you come and join the classes, and you must make sure you have to clear what you have failed in the last class. And administration said that the carryover that you were having in first year, you have to go back and complete it to restart it. That only one course for one full year, and we are advancing. We need to complete our study this year.
Another student who prefers to be identified only as Anyang for fear of reprisals from the university's administration says students resorted to locking the university's offices after several attempts at negotiation failed.
The system was indoors when the students were away for long 3 years, and the coronavirus affect the people seriously. When the people try to turn up for supplementaries, they fail to come because there is a total lockdown. So the student tried the level best with the student union to go and to negotiate what will be solution of it. But the administration of John Garang University refused to solve our problem.
Anyang is urging the university's administration to allow students to go to the next classes in order to avoid chaos. He says some students are already unhappy after spending nearly a decade in the campus without graduating. Dr. Nartiso Odongi, the academic registrar at the Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology, says more than 150 students who either failed exams or missed sitting for their exams have been asked to refit their classes, which angered the students, prompting them to shut down university operations.
They are forcing us, the administration, to allow them to go to the next class, but we are insisting that it is not academic way of doing things. You have to clear yourself, then you go to the next class. Now, they have blocked the studies, but we have already insist, and we brought the security around, or the police around.
Dr. Odongi insists that all students were alerted in 2019 after the new system, which states that whoever fails or misses examinations must repeat their class. Odongi has this warning for students who keep university offices and classrooms locked.
If the students continue with the strike, they do not allow staff to go to the classes, which means the university will decide. The administration of the top administration of the university will decide either to close the university because there will be no need of staying in the university while it is closed.
Dr. Odongi is urging the students to respect the university's new academic system and call off the strike so that lectures and normal operations can resume on the campus. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at HIV-positive babies in Kenya. Stay tuned for that story after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. And in our Tuesday health segment, we take a look at babies living with HIV. More than half of all HIV-positive babies in Kenya are resistant to one or more antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs, even before they begin the treatment. This is according to a new study by the Kenya Medical Research Institute that says ARV resistance among children has been growing since 2014. Maureen Ojiambo reports for VOA from Sacramento, California.
2014 was the earliest year that researchers of the Kenya Medical Research Institute, KEMRI, picked up samples for the study of resistance to antiretroviral drugs among children in Kenya. They collected dried blood spots from infants below the age of 18 months through the Kenya Early Infant Diagnosis Program in 2014, 2017, and 2018. In 2014, nearly 58% of the babies had drug-resistant mutations. KEMRI senior research scientist Sheila Kageha says there is a need to carry out more studies to investigate the impacts of such mutations.
Findings were from a cross-sectional study in infants born to HIV-positive mothers newly diagnosed with HIV. It would be interesting to carry out more longitudinal studies to investigate the impact of these mutations on the antiretroviral therapy outcomes among these infants, including their mothers.
Kageha says despite the government's support for HIV awareness campaigns, pregnant mothers are not attending clinics as required, thereby putting the unborn babies at risk. She says the increase was because of possible maternal exposure to antiretroviral therapy.
Another issue is suboptimal adherence to ART amongst some of these mothers. There are still barriers in accessing HIV testing and treatment in some of these regions. There's also a challenge on retention in care. Mothers, due to other factors, don't return to ANC as required. WHO has recommended four antenatal clinic visits for this group, but then most of them do not get to meet those requirements.
According to the World Health Organization, over the past decade, the world has witnessed an increase in the use of antiretroviral therapy, which has saved the lives of millions of people living with HIV/AIDS. However, the increased use of HIV medicines comes with the emergency of HIV drug resistance. As a result, many people find that their HIV medicines are not working. Kageha says HIV drug resistance is a global challenge that government should address.
HIV drug resistance remains a significant challenge globally, particularly in resource-limited settings where HIV policies and healthcare gaps limit HIV drug resistance surveillance and also prevention and handling of virologic failure. However, Kenya, like any other global state, has national action plans to prevent, monitor, and respond to HIV drug resistance. These plans are informed by the Global Action Plan on HIV drug resistance, coordinated by the WHO.
According to UNICEF, the number of children living with HIV in Kenya fell from 180,000 in 2010 to 111,500 in 2020, partly due to improved access to services. The World Health Organization's report on HIV drug resistance 2021 says nearly one half of infants born to mothers infected with HIV have HIV drug resistance to one or more NNRTI, a drug that helps keep the disease from spreading. Close to 107,000 Kenyan children below 14 years of age are living with HIV, but only about 73,000 are receiving treatment. Reporting for Views, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
Still on health matters, an expert group of 270 climate scientists warns that their impact of climate change soon will be irreversible unless governments act decisively to tackle these imminent global threats. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on the launch of the latest report by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
IPCC's chairman, Ho-Sung Lee, does not mince words. He says the stakes of our planet have never been higher.
Human activities have warmed the climate at a rate not seen in at least the past 2,000 years. We are on course to reaching global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius within the next two decades. And temperature will continue to rise unless the world takes much bolder action.
He says the action governments take today will shape how people will be able to adapt to climate change and how nature will respond to increasing climate risks. Deborah Roberts is co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, which produced the report. She says the scientific evidence that climate change is a threat to human well-being and the health of the planet is unequivocal.
Climate change combines with unsustainable use of natural resources, habitat destruction, deforestation, and growing urbanization, as well as inequity and marginalization. 3.3 to 3.6 billion people live in global hotspots of high vulnerability to climate change.
These include parts of Africa, as well as South Asia, Central and South America, small islands, and the Arctic. The report warns people living in these hotspots will likely experience severe food shortages leading to malnutrition should global temperatures rise by 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. Despite these dire predictions, scientists say the report presents a reality check on what has been done to stem global warming and what remains to be done. They say the report offers solutions on how to adapt to climate change and mitigate their worst effects. Scientists say some challenges can be addressed by creating a more equitable and sustainable world, by moving away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and by using indigenous knowledge to protect nature. These steps, along with adaptation and mitigation projects, can help create change, but poorer countries will need wealthier countries to help finance them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions that followed has pushed the price of oil to over $100 per barrel, the highest level in 8 years. It has also opened an opportunity for African oil producers like Nigeria, Angola, Libya, and Algeria to cash in more crude oil exports. But a lack of refineries in Africa means crude oil exporters will also have to pay more for imported fuel. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Crude oil prices hit $105 per barrel last week, the highest mark since 2014, and up by 47% since December, amid fears that supplies from Russia may be impacted by its war with Ukraine. Russia accounts for about 10% of the world's crude oil output, making it the third biggest producer globally behind the United States and Saudi Arabia. But experts say the Ukraine invasion and the sanctions slapped on Russia by Europe and the United States could significantly reduce demand for Russian products and increase the demand for Africa's. Isaac Boti is a public finance expert in Abuja.
For Africa, it's a kind of game we can look into. It's an opportunity. It presents that window of opportunity for African countries to see how they can increase their production capacity and meet the needs of the global demand of crude.
Nigeria is Africa's largest producer of oil at about 1.9 million barrels a day, followed by Libya, Angola, and Algeria. That positions those countries to reap windfall profits from rising oil prices. But economic analyst Paul Enyim notes that Nigeria will have to pay on the other end for finished products like gasoline.
At the end of the day, it's going to hit on our economy. We may think, you understand, we will gain. Perhaps oil prices will go up because of the crises here and there. But hey, remember, we don't refine our crude oil.
All of Nigeria's refineries were shut down in 2020 because of money and maintenance issues and have yet to reopen. The country now depends entirely on imports to meet its fuel needs. For weeks, Nigeria has been battling to increase its national fuel supply after authorities recalled millions of liters of tainted imported petrol from circulation, causing a major shortage in West Africa's most populous nation. In contrast, Algeria, which does have refineries, said this week that it would supply Europe with petroleum products if necessary. But he says it's a good example for other African nations.
We need to develop our capacity to produce locally. We need to concentrate on our industrialization policies and see how we can expand this base. We need to look at various trade agreements that are existing.
As Russia's war on Ukraine persists, experts say the shift in focus on Africa could be both a blessing and a burden. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. We now end the show with Mawa and the song Binia.
Reaching out to the brokenhearted, I'm reaching out to the lost souls, I'm reaching out to the absent-minded, I'm reaching out to the sick and the low. I'm reaching out to the brokenhearted, I'm reaching out to the lost souls, I'm reaching out to the absent-minded, I'm reaching out to the sick and the low. Ana bimiru idatai, bijuru vita, kanita waga. Ana biguna guna tai, bijibu fara, kangilpa waja. Ana maderi tageni barao, ae.
We have been listening to Mawa and the song Binia. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Through the stumbles and through the falls, I will always be there for you, by your side, day and night, and I ain't never gonna let you go. When the nights get in the